Welcome this afternoon. The House Judiciary Committee is in session. It's 5 minutes past one. In attendance are Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, Representative Ramos, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes. We anticipate seeing Representative Samuels walk through the door any moment. We have four bills that we're going to take up today. House Bill 163, House Bill 3, House Bill 151, House Bill 225, all four of which are bills previously heard. First on the docket today is House Bill 163. Public testimony is still open, I believe. I have a CS. Madam Vice Chair, would you move to adopt the this has already been adopted. This is from last week. So we have the CS for House Bill 163 before us, an act relating to real property foreclosures, to the sale of property on execution, and to deeds of trust. I think we have Stefan Routh on line with us. Stefan, are you with us?
I am.
Good afternoon. It's. Are you in Alaska or are you outside of the state?
I'm in Alaska, in Anchorage today.
Welcome. Happy to have you back. I'm trying to remember where we left off with this bill. We had a couple of issues. One of them centers around the concern over 5 days, and I'm trying to recollect if there was a second concern that was on the table. Do any of the members recollect? I know that we have we have Representative Holmes's amendment that we will consider shortly. And what else did you have, Representative Dahlstrom?
I have a note that we spent discussion on what a public place was, what constituted a...
Are there any other members that recollect? Representative Samuels is with us. Are there any members who recollect any other direct concerns that we had with House Bill 163 other than the five-day time frame and perhaps public places? I don't remember public places. Do you?
We must have resolved it because I show this is our area of concern.
Okay. And Stefan, I indicated to Representative Holmes as we sat down, she has an amendment that would delete the reference of up to the five-day reference. And I indicated. I indicated that you had a rationale of why that figure could safely be reduced, but should not be eliminated. And that reference is on page 3, lines 25 and 26. Stefan, before we close public testimony, can you go over that rationale for us as to why we should not consider an amendment that would delete that reference, please?
Please. It's my feeling that the thing we're trying to remedy here is the last minute at the courthouse, the sale envelope, which is the time that breeds most litigation and foreclosures, is that stuff that happens at the sale. And one of the things that happens at the sale is reinstatements that should have been really thought of a little bit sooner. So I know other states have addressed this by moving back that reinstatement date. Washington, for example, has 10 days. You do not have to accept a reinstatement within 10 days of the auction. I think that's too long. That's why we had proposed 5 days. I'd be satisfied if it dropped down to 3 or even 2 days. Just move it away from the auction itself. The auction should be a time to maximize bidding for the benefit of the borrower, not a time to have... lots of activity concerning reinstatement. I was calculating before the hearing, if we left it at 5 days, the minimum time to foreclose in Alaska under law now is 120 days. That's 90 days for the foreclosure and 30 days of default before you can foreclose. So if we took away 5 days, we're leaving 96% of the time, or 115 days, to reinstate. But typically, the time is much more than that because I know institutions typically have files or loans about 3 months delinquent before a foreclosure even begins. So the typical period is 6 months of time to reinstate. And under the five-day proposal, like is in the present statute, That takes away only 2.7% of the time, leaving 97.3% of the time to effectuate a reinstatement, or 175 days. That all being said, if we just move it away from that sale time, I'd be satisfied. 2 days would be fine with me. 3 days would be fine.
Okay.
To move it away a little bit.
All right, Stephan, thank you very much. Representative Holmes has a question, and then Gruenberg. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know, generally in practice, when if somebody's going to come in, if the owner's going to come in and pay this off, how often does it actually occur that close within, say, 48 hours of the auction? Is that common for people to basically show up at the courtroom steps and with the money in hand? No,
it's very uncommon. When it happens, it creates enormous problems. So it's not a frequent occurrence, but it's a big consequence when it does occur.
Stephan, is it fair to say it happens a lot in the movies?
That is fair to say, yes.
Go ahead, Representative Holmes, follow up.
I only watch Rambo.
Yeah, I bet you do, Representative Gruenberg. You remind me of him. Except for the hair. Representative Holmes.
So, Mr. Ruth, you were saying that you would be amenable to, say, a 48-hour rule or something like that, a two-day rule?
I would.
Five? Okay, thank you.
Very good. Representative Gruenberg. Representative Rambo.
No, I was just going to say I hope that we could come to an accommodation of 48 hours.
Okay. Very good. Are there any other questions for Mr. Routh?
No.
All right. Stephan, thank you very much. You're welcome to stay online as we work through this final leg of your bill. We thank you for your assistance, and thank you for bringing this to the attention of myself and this committee. Is there anybody else online that wants just to testify? Anybody else in the room that wishes to testify? As such, public testimony is closed on House Bill 163. Are there any amendments, Representative Holmes?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I would like to not offer the amendment I have here in front of you. Instead, I'd like to offer a conceptual amendment in its place.
All right. So we have a conceptual amendment number one before us.
I move conceptual amendment number one, which would be on page 3, line 25. At the end of the line, it would be to delete the word 5 and replace it with the word 2. As in T-W-O.
We have conceptual amendment number one before us. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, amendment number one passes. Are there any other amendments? Is there any discussion by the committee? Seeing none, the chair would entertain a motion on House Bill 163. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the CS for House Bill number 163, version K, with a conceptual amendment and any attached physical note.
Thank you. Seeing no objection, House Bill 163 passes from committee. Thank you for your help, Representative Holmes. Stephan, thank you very much for your participation in the process. All right, and next we are going to take up House Bill 3. Representative Gruenberg, do you have your amendments ready for House Bill 3?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Before us is House Bill 3, an act relating to issuance of identification cards and to issuance of driver's licenses and providing for an effective date. We do have Director Bannock here and available to answer questions during committee discussion. However, public testimony is closed for the bill. I believe that we had some discussion, and I'm trying to recollect because of the timeline. Representative Lynn, we went through the bill.
Mr. Chair, we went through the bill, and as we left the last hearing, you had requested us to work on a grace period, and an amendment was we have that before. I think I don't know who sponsored an amendment. I'm not.
I think I have an amendment. Is that right? I have an amendment number one. 225.
Okay. Yes, you do have an amendment.
Hang on just a second.
You have an amendment.
Let me see if I have it here.
Wait, Mr. Chair?
Oh, here they are. I got it.
There are three amendments, one, three, and four.
Yep.
Four
amendments. I've got it. Found it. Dwayne, Director Bannock, would you come up here and be available for questions for the committee, please? Okay, I see amendment number one was scratched.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would prefer if we could take your amendment first and then come back to mine.
Okay.
All right, and as I understand it, I'm not offering amendment two. So
that is correct. So if the members will, everybody will take their packet and turn to the amendment labeled number three, but this will become amendment number one. For page 3, line 20. And as we had discussions with the director, the determination that we reached is that this isn't necessarily a rural amendment. This actually is an amendment for all Alaskans, including those of us at this table who may get so busy that our licenses expire. So we have deleted the word expired on line 20 and insert been expired for more than 12 months. So it would read a person who is seeking a renewal of, duplicate of, or change of legal name on a license is presumed to meet the requirements of this subparagraph if the license has not been expired for more than 12 months, which gives ample opportunity for all Alaskans that are a little bit late across the state of Alaska to qualify at the DMV for replacing their expired driver's license with a new driver's license. Do I have a correct understanding, Director?
Yes, sir. That is the way I understand this amendment.
Is there, I should have asked for an objection for the purposes of
discussion. For discussion purposes.
Okay, my apologies. So I moved amendment number one. There's been an objection. Are there any questions or further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lynn.
As I understand it, Director Bannock can correct me if I'm wrong. When you move into the state, from another state, and I had some kids who did that, some more coming this summer, they will have, I believe, up to 90 days to renew their licenses, not to renew, but to get an Alaska license if they move into the state.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
I believe that in regulation that's true for military and for college students, but that's also true for out-of-state people that move to Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, it's in statute under the section of persons not required to have a driver's license. If you are here for less than 90 days, and then it quantifies it to say 90 days, after 90 days, then you have to have a driver's license to continue to drive.
So I'm wondering, Mr. Chair, might not be appropriate to match it to that because, 90 days, a year is a very, very long time. I'm wondering if maybe 90 days might be more appropriate to make it consistent with those who would move to Alaska. And would that work a great inconvenience to anybody?
Director Bannock, do you have a preference for 90 days or 12 months?
Original language.
No. Mr. Chairman, if I can just expand on that just super briefly. Super briefly.
Director Bannock, you could take all the time in the world. We just blew through a bill in 15 minutes. When
I had the privilege of appearing before you last week, there was a question that came up that I think is kind of specific to this entire paragraph. And that was Representative Holmes had asked a question, if there was any other statutes that had to be changed in order to be real ID compliant. And I told you, no, there was not. This entire section that you just read,
yes, sir.
Sir, is not real ID compliant. Thus, I will tell you today, any changes that you make inside of that paragraph clearly doesn't have anything to do with that. And thus, to answer your very specific question, do we prefer 90 days or 12 months, I defer to the wisdom of the judiciary because it is just purely a policy call.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Are there other thoughts on since I can't accept a friendly amendment because there's no such thing.
Could I present a neutral amendment to the amendment?
Well, I'd like to get some of the members' thoughts as to the difference between 3 months and 12 months, but before you do, Representative Lynn. Jim, Representative Cockhill.
Mr. Chairman, it seems that right now, if you have an expired license, well, maybe what I should ask the director so that I'm not guessing at this. Certainly, if I expire in August.
Your license expires.
Yeah. Hopefully, I don't expire at the same time my license. If I forget about it, which has happened, what is the time frame that that I have for renewal outside of this law as we have it? Help me understand where we're at right now.
Presently, you mean?
Presently, yeah.
Representative Cockhill, through the chair, when a driver's license expires, state statutes say, so has your privilege to drive. There's no perceived grace period anywhere in statutes as to your ability to continue to drive. Your relationship at the DMV, when you come in a day late, 3 days late, 3 months late, we say, you're tardy, happy belated birthday, and we continue the process. By regulation, if you are more than 12 months expired, you have to retake the knowledge test or the written exam. If you are expired by 5 years, again by regulation, then you also have to take the skills test or driving test. There's no financial penalties, but those are the two trigger points at the DMV today. 12 months, got to retake the written test. 5 years, have to retake the road test.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Cox,
I tend to agree with the carrier of the bill that when people move in here, we have give them 90 days. And then we run into all other issues since this is becoming more and more for identification purposes. I know that bank cashing, everything to PFD eligibility, you know, could be an issue here. I don't know, but if we put it a year, we might actually run into some of those problems that I don't know what they would be. I tend to like the 90-day issue.
Okay, Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A concern that comes to mind that I don't know the answer, but I'm wondering how extending it any length of time would cause problems for the Department of Public Safety with address updates and when they're looking for people or pull people over and don't have current, it just comes to mind.
Representative Dahlstrom makes a very valid point, I believe, that we would be putting something in statute that will use the phrase that there is literally a grace period. Now, the grace period is speaking to this section, which has to do with your reestablishment of your legal presence. That is certainly what this is about. But I don't know that there's any other place in statute where we reference outside of that military and college student regulation that you cited, where is there any confusion at this body that when my driver's license expires on my birthday, even though under this amendment I have X amount of days to come in, is my driver's license still valid? And I think that we really muddy up the waters there a little bit. I totally understand the chair's point that you made. We talked about it, and I don't even know that I disagree with it. But it does put something into statute that does that mean that my driver's license is still valid for more than the day after it expired? I clearly don't think that's what your intent is.
I don't think so either. Okay. I appreciate Representative Kaka.
Just we're talking about renewal or duplicate. And so I think that's where we need to kind of keep focused on. And because we're going to add some significant requirements under the drop-dead issue, which I think that kind of caught your attention. So it's unless I'm wrong, it looks like we're seeking a renewal or duplicate or change of legal name, et cetera. So it's not the issuance of a driver's license.
Correct.
It's not the ability to drive, anything like that. It's just getting a new issuance.
Proving your presence.
Right.
As such, I will accept the amendment to the amendment. So we have before us amendment number one that maintains the reference to expired and modifies the reference been expired for more than 12 months to been expired for more than, shall we say, 90 days? Is that the amendment?
It'd probably be better because months have different.
Yes, so been expired for more than 90 days. is the amendment to amendment number one. Is the objection maintained?
To amendment number one? No, sir.
The objection is removed. Seeing no objection, amendment one is passed. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Could you direct us to amendment number two, please?
Thank you.
Which one is it?
Just for the record, I will not be offering the amendment that was previously labeled amendment number two. It was C2. That won't be offered. The next one I'd like to offer, the first one I'd like to offer, is the one that was labeled amendment number one at C5. If we could label that amendment number two. And I'll offer amendment number two.
We have amendment number two before us. Is there an objection?
I'll object. Thank you.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for discussion. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some people who are unable, because of for bureaucratic reasons, to complete their paperwork and get their green cards. And this is modeled on Virginia law, and the member should have a copy of the law of Virginia with that relevant language in there. And this would allow people who are waiting these applications, have pending applications, to get a driver's license.
Thank you. Director Bannock, can you tell us what the Department of Motor Vehicles stance is on amendment number two?
Sir, we support amendment number two.
Okay, very good. Is the objection maintained?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hear from the sponsor of the bill. I
accept amendment number two.
Representative Samuels?
Yes, I've got a question for Mr. Bannock. A pending application for asylum.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Re-object. It's okay. Go ahead.
On number two, a pending application for asylum in the United States. Entering the United States for refugee status. Examples of pending asylum. Does somebody show up on our shores and they're immediately pending asylum? Everybody, everybody requests it. I mean, assuming the first thing out of my mouth, if I were shown in the United States, it would be political asylum.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I can't give you the technical expertise on that. What I can say is that when this discussion was had, and we discussed attempting to define, instead of using the language that is in the bill, that's relatively broad-based, a person's legal presence, we're looking to define it a little more accurately. Now, it's fair to say Alaska has never had a legal presence law before, yet as I testified before, there are 40 other states that do. So. In working with Representative Grunberg's office and others, one of the suggestions I made was, let's go find one. And indeed, Representative Grunberg has brought to the table today the great state of Virginia and a very defined six-point plan. I have reviewed it with my head of driver licensing, and today she and I spent some time on the telephone, and we cannot find a model of a person standing at the DMV that we intend to give a driver's license to that would not fit into one of those six. Now, how can we specifically get to some of the, I think that one was number three, I believe it was, that you're referencing?
Do you have the amendment?
Number two.
I don't have that one. I'm sorry. I saw it.
Number two is pending asylum. Number four is pending temporary protective status. Number six is a pending application.
he has it now.
I have it now, sir. And if I just may, these are words that are consistent with Immigration and Control, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. This is verbatim some of their language. To answer your very specific question, when you get to the shore and you say asylum, is there a person there from ICE that fills out? I couldn't give you that minutia, sir, but clearly there is protection by the federal government for a person that is in one of these six statuses. And as I've always maintained, the Division of Motor Vehicles has always maintained, legal presence is about including all of the people that are legally in America, and a person legally in America will fit into one of these six categories.
Thank you. Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to back up with what the director is saying, it's true. Everybody who fits in any one of these categories is actually legally here and therefore should be legally entitled to have a driver's license while they're here. I can speak particularly to number six, It's I actually had a family member who was in that status for 2.5 years, entered the country legally, was required to file an application to change to a different status. INS was so backed up, it took them 2.5 years to process the application. There was no legal document during those 2.5 years. If you ask this person, this family member of mine, for proof that they were legally in the country, they did not have it. They were here legally. If you checked with INS, they were here legally, working legally, waiting the grant of a green card. And it took INS 2.5 years. And their official status for that entire time was pending adjustment of status. That was the legal status. It was 100% legal. Played by all the rules, paid all the money, stood in all the lines, did everything right. There's no piece of paper that says this person is here legally at this moment, because the piece of paper they received was from INS was, we've received your legal application on time, and we'll get around to it when we get around to it, and in the meantime, carry on. And I want to make sure people like that who are playing by all the rules, we have some pretty tough rules out there for people to follow. I want to make sure people who are here legally following the rules can get a driver's license. While you're in that adjustment of status, you can't leave the country. So you can't go home and renew your driver's license in your old country and drive under that. So we would really be hanging these people out to dry.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Another question for this, for the director would be, how long is that driver's license going to be good for? The way the bill is written right now. So I am a pending applicant for asylum in the United States, and you can now issue me an ID because I'm a pending, and I can prove that I'm a pending asylum. How long is that driver's license good for?
It would be good, sir, until your next birthday in 5 years.
Whether or not I got rejected.
That is correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunberg.
On that point, I would consider it a friendly conceptual amendment if we put in there to expire on the next birthday as, you know, for five, as what Director Bannock said, unless you are rejected, in which place it expires. I have no problem with that.
I have a little bit of trouble following that conceptual language.
The point is not to get their license in their hand, because once they get the license in their hand,
right,
it doesn't matter if the government thinks it's no good or not. You're still using it as a United States ID. Mm-hmm. So if it were a shorter time frame, looking for a little help here,
a year,
6 months, how long does it take to get an asylum application in?
Mr. Chairman,
long, Director.
Representative Samuels, you can actually go on a website and you can actually see what the projected waiting times are. I will tell you that there are some statuses that exceed 2 years. It's posted today that your line is a 2.5 hour long, two and a half year long line. I certainly understand your position, and that creates a problem that we've attempted to mitigate with HB3. Forgive me because I don't know what the right answer is. I know that this language is verbatim from Virginia, and.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Coghill first.
The driver's license issued to this is only valid during the period of time the person is authorized to stay and must show the expiration date. And so if there's authorizations indefinite, then it's only good for the year from issuance. So would we then require issuance and I was reading while you guys were answering that question, but I was trying to find this is Section 6 in the bill that actually gave the direction. And so does this put tension in that direction, I guess?
Representative Grunberg?
If the members would look at the Virginia Act, Dwayne, do you have the Virginia?
I don't have it with me, sir. I saw it.
Okay. There's language in the Virginia Act that's circled, and that's the language that's in the amendment. But the Virginia Act goes on to deal with Representative Samuels' problem. And I have a bad problem with my eye here. I don't have any problem with putting the rest of the Virginia language in. I think that would solve that problem.
All right.
If I could ask Mr. Bannock, did you have a chance? Would you review that?
I did, Mr. Chairman.
Bannock.
Representative Grunberg. In a different part of HB3, which may come up in a couple of minutes, we talk about that line. We talk about the indefinite status. And so right now in HB 3, if HB 3 passes along with Amendment Number 2, and a person is in pending status into perpetuity, then they would only have it for 1 year, 1 year at a time. And they would have to come back in a year from now, say, we need to re-up, for instance. We're still in pending status. That's the way HB 3 reads at this minute.
Representative Grimberg.
Mr. Chair, so that, I think, is one answer. And if, given the conversation that we've just had, if this amendment passes, Amendment 2, I will not offer the last amendment. I don't want to create that problem. The Virginia language is alternative language, and I would also accept that.
All right. Representative Cargo?
Well, the way I understand it, though, on the anniversary of that year, if a person came in showing correspondence back from INS that they have an application pending, to you that's legal enough to say, okay, we renew at that point, true?
Yes, sir. If there's no end date on that, then you would still stick in the 1 year. We have a 1 year limiter in the bill right now for things that are indefinite. Mm-hmm. Now, if it comes back and it says, okay, great news, Representative Coghill, you're here for the next 18 months, then the bill also addresses that you're only going to get an 18-month driver's license.
So do we need to be explicit in this? For example, indefinite and put pending, if the stay is pending legal status or indefinite?
I don't know how I can answer this. Right now, I don't believe that's a necessity because of the limiter that you will find on for the driver's license specifically on page 4, lines 23 and 24. Mm-hmm.
And this would be treated, Mr. Chairman, if I may, mm-hmm. This would be treated as an indefinite if you have pending application?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I totally concur with that statement.
Okay. Right.
Representative Grimberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask Mr. Bannock. Mr. Bannock, we now have the language that's on page 2, I'm sorry, on page 4, lines 23 and 24. We're looking at section 6 of the bill. You're really focusing on that, are you not, sir?
Yes, sir.
Do you prefer that language or the Virginia language to deal with this issue? I think the Virginia language, well, I don't know. Which it's your choice. They're both somewhat the same.
They are, and I think the difference between the Virginia language, the Virginia language is very specific to items 1 through 6, whereas in our bill today, lines 23 through 24 are for the whole gamut. You're not necessarily in sections 1 through 6. You're here. You have a permanent resident card, for instance. Now, I've been told anecdotally that there are very, very few people in the United States of America that are here permanently. It's called a permanent residency card, but you still have to renew it every 10 years, even though you are here permanently. Mm-hmm. It is my opinion, and in our research showing from other states, that that person is not an indefinite person, because they have to go back to the United States government and re-up in their 10-year block. If we took the Virginia language and made it specific to these 6 statuses, I mean, that's what we get. It's a teeter-totter. I think at the end of the day, we have the exact same result. If we line up 100 of these customers, we're going to have the exact same result, whether we take that line and attach it to this amendment or we leave HB 3 in its current presence. I don't think that we're really going to alter the course of the earth.
Director Bannock, I think we're all happy, at least I'm the chair satisfied with Section 6 as it's written. So the question that I have is that if we accept Amendment Number 2, which we intend to do, is it addressed adequately by Section 6, or do we want to adopt some more specific language that address specifically sections, you know, 1 through 6
in Roman numerals. I believe that the instructions to the DMV are crystal clear.
As is drafted by Alaskan, yes, the drafters and legal, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bannock, if the period of authorized stay is indefinite, so if the website said that I had asylum and it was going to take me 2.5 years to get to the decision point, not to get it, I still might get turned down, and it said 2.5 years, do you consider that a 2.5 year waiting period or an indefinite waiting period?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I'd consider that one an indefinite.
Okay, because the point isn't to stop Representative Holmes' relative. The point is when Muhammad Atta comes to this country to make sure he doesn't get a driver's license. I think that's the goal. You can't keep your eye on, or you got to keep your eye on the ball here.
Right.
So giving somebody a 5-year ID and even a 1-year ID for somebody who comes in, applies for asylum with no intention of getting the asylum, but the intention is to do harm to this country. And that is the problem.
Driver's license in their pocket.
With a U.S. ID.
Yeah. So, Representative Samuels, what are your thoughts then?
If Mr. Bannock is happy with indefinite and the year, but even a year is a long time, I hate to be a hassle to the people, the 99.9% of the people that are here, perfectly fine, but they're not the point of the entire bill either. So I have no amendments to the amendment.
Okay. Representative Grimberg, do you wish to amend your amendment with any of the Virginia language?
Or, no, if the director is happy, I'm okay.
If the director is satisfied, then I will remove my objection. Seeing no objection, amendment number 2 passes. Representative Grimberg?
I will not offer any other amendments.
All right. As such, we have HB3 before us. Matthew Kerr has been listening in through the LIO, but as we stated earlier, a public testimony is closed. With that, the chair would entertain a motion. And Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would make a motion to move House Bill number 3, version C, with attached conceptual and written amendments. And is there a fiscal note?
Seeing no objection, House Bill 3 passes from committee and heads to the floor. Is that right, Representative Lynn? The rules and then the floor?
I think it goes to finance.
Is there a fiscal note?
I'd like to thank the committee, Mr. Chair, for hearing and moving this bill.
You're welcome. There is a fiscal note. Director Bannock, thank you for your assistance. Next is House Bill 151. Is there anybody here from Representative Johnson's office? Okay. All right. We do have a public testimony, and public testimony is still open on House Bill 151.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grimberg.
Have we adopted the L version? We did. Okay.
I have adopted on my form that it is adopted.
Okay.
While we're waiting for somebody from Representative Johnson's office, we have Boyd Morgenthaler with Alaska Pro Design is available for questions, and we have Leanne Boldenow with Marsh USA who does wish to testify. Can we go to Leanne, please?
Sure. Good morning, Chair, and I'm sorry I didn't hear. Is Representative Craig Johnson there as well?
Representative Johnson had a root canal. We are awaiting somebody from his staff to come over in his place. We're familiar with this bill. We think most of the issues have been addressed. If you would like to lend your testimony, we would appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you. My name is Leanne Boldenow, and I represent Marsh as an insurance brokerage. And I work with about 30 design firms statewide. And I had written a letter in support of this bill in March, identifying poorly written, uninsurable contract language that's released by state agencies. And I'm in support of this bill as it would be in alignment with professional liability insurance for the design professional.
Okay.
So I'm here to testify in support of the bill or the reference as far as insurability.
I'm sorry, you said you are testifying in support of the bill?
Correct.
Are there any questions for Leanne? We don't see any. If you'd like to stand by, Leanne, we appreciate it. We also have Jim Cantor available from the Attorney General's office for House Bill 151. And as I said, Boyd Morgenthaler is also available from Alaska Pro Design. Are there any questions for any of these folks? Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd actually like to hear Jim Cantor's take on this bill, since you mentioned he's available online.
All right. Jim, are you there? Mr. Cantor?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, Mr. Cantor. Representative Holmes requested your take on House Bill 151. I am aware that the Association of General Contractors and the Alaska Builders and Contractors have both reviewed this and said that there's a minimal amount of risk as they perceive it. Would you give us your thoughts from the AG's office, please?
This bill, the last speaker really hit on it. This bill really has to do with insurability. It has to do with negligent acts that cause liability. So basically third-party claims, not the claims between the contractor and the agency or the claims between the sub and the contractor, which are contract claims, but it has to do with somebody getting injured and suing the person who built it or designed it or owns it, and basically tort claims. The insurance world between contractors and the state is worked out. This type of insurance is apparently available to cover this risk. Between consultants, which are basically your designers, and the public agency, apparently full insurance is not available. And so this bill addresses that situation to work out how risk should be handled when insurance is not available.
So the Attorney General's office supports this bill as it's written?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you. Follow up, if I may. So, Mr. Cantor, you think that this is a looking out for the state's best interest here. Do you think that having this type of standardized language is in the state's best interest or at the very least not going to terribly adversely impact the state?
I guess through the chair, Representative Holmes, I would buy into that last statement. This is very similar to the language that DOT and most of the state agencies use already. There's a few agencies that do not, and I think that's where this bill is aimed.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Dan, are there any other questions for Mr. Cantor from the committee members? All right. Are there any member questions from the members for the sponsor of the bill? Is there anyone online who wishes to testify who has not?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
This is Boyd Morgenthaler.
Hi, Boyd. Welcome.
Hi. I am a representative of the Alaska Professional Design Council. I testified before on this bill during the House State Affairs. Alaska Professional Design Council is a consortium of professional societies that represents about 5,000 architects, engineers, and land surveyors registered in Alaska. And I'd just like to put on the record that APDC and myself personally strongly supports this bill. Basically, this just levels out the playing field for insurance and liability questions in tort, and really will help all of us in the architect engineering industry achieve negotiate contracts much more smoothly. As today, there's just a wide range of the way people write these, and standardization along the lines of the DOT form, which this bill does, will just really help the industry a lot. That's essentially it. We're strongly in support.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to offer public testimony on this bill? Okay, with that, we're going to close public testimony on House Bill 151. We do have a member from the sponsor's office. Is there any statement that you wish to make on this?
Yes, Madam Chair, and let me start off by apologizing for being tardy. I was testifying for another bill in the Resource Committee.
Glad you're here.
Thank you for
at least you didn't have a root canal.
Please identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Trevor Fulton. I'm staff for Representative Craig Johnson.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I guess.
Again, I apologize for missing the prior part of the conversation. I suppose just to wrap things up, I know we did have a fairly lengthy conversation on this bill last time around. And I would like to make sure that everybody's concerns from that discussion was addressed. To that effect, I want to reiterate, one, that House Bill 151 pertains only to construction-related contracts, and we addressed that in the committee substitute that came out of State Affairs Committee and the committee substitute that's before you now. It doesn't have any repercussions outside of the construction realm, whether it be financial, whether it affects the Permanent Fund Dividend Corporation or university or anything else along those lines. Secondly, the bill is not directly related to issues between builders and public contracting agencies. And I believe at the conclusion of the last discussion we had before the committee, it was asked that we get the blessing of the Associated General Contractors and the Associated Builders and Contractors to that effect, and we did do that, and I believe we directed that towards Representative Ramres. Thirdly, the DOT language that this bill seeks to standardize across all public agencies does not extend to builders, and to do so would significantly alter the bill and would cause it to no longer mirror DOT contracts. So while that may be another issue that would need to be addressed further on down the line, to do so with this bill would very much change the nature of it. It would expand it considerably, and we would be dealing with a whole nother animal. And then one final question that I wanted to make sure was addressed was, there's a fair amount of discussion about how subcontractors fit into the picture, and I spoke to somebody in the Attorney General's office, and their reply, or at least the short answer of their reply, was that subcontractors are only covered under the terms of the separate contract that would exist between them and the agency or the company that they were contracted with. So it's my understanding that how they fit into the picture pertains more to the contract that they have existing between them and whoever they're contracting with, not necessarily with the public agency contract that this bill is addressing.
All right, thank you, Trevor. Are there any questions from committee members? All righty. Mr. Chair, just so you know, we did close public testimony, and there are no questions from committee members. With that, I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Any objections? All right, with that, the CS for House Bill number 51, version L, 25. Excuse me, 151, I apologize, is moved from committee.
Thank you. Excellent job, Trevor. Tell Representative Johnson we hope he gets well soon. And I assume you're not moving. 225 is also Representative Johnson's bill? Okay. All right.
We're at ease.
We're back on the record. It is 5 minutes to two. 2 minutes to two. Jeannie, you look very nice today. It's a pleasure to have you before the committee. I will remind members that public testimony on House Bill 225 is closed. This is an act relating to misconduct involving weapons and bail. We have listening in Brian Judy with the NRA, who has indicated that he would like to testify. However, Brian, public testimony is closed on this issue.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lynn.
I was absent for another bill someplace.
Yes, sir.
And I didn't get to hear all the public testimony, including Mr. Judy.
Yes, sir. What's the request, Representative Lynn?
Well, I wonder if we might hear Mr. Judy.
No, we may not. Public testimony is closed. It would be unfair to others, is my concern.
Since the last time we met, the CS was adopted to as the work draft, and there have been two amendments that have been circulated to you. Amendment one changes the bill by separating the...
Jeannie, is Amendment one by Representative Johnson? Is
yes.
That okay? Go ahead,
it should be listed as M2.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chairman, you want me to move that so we can get it up and going?
Yeah, Jenny, let's do that. Representative Carkill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move amendment number one, which is the M.2 version with Representative Johnson's name on it.
And I'll object.
Representative Dahlstrom objects. We have amendment number one before us. Jenny, if you'll go ahead and describe these changes for us, please.
The changes are splitting the misdemeanor and the felonies. If you're charged with a felony and you're caught with a concealed gun, then you'll be charged with another felony. If you're charged with a misdemeanor and you're caught with a concealed gun while on bail or on release, then you would be charged with a misdemeanor. So it separates the second charge.
Are there questions? Just give us just a moment, please. Mm-hmm. Representative Coghill, is amendment number one consistent with amendment number two, or are both are both just clarifying amendments?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
one of them is the charge, and one of them is the condition. So my concern prior to this was if you had a misdemeanor and you were given a conditional probation, you could actually be charged with a felony for having a misdemeanor infraction with probation. So I thought they should be equal to, and so this is kind of the answer to that during the charging part of this.
Are you going to offer, through the chair, to Representative Coghill, are you offering amendment two?
I will be offering amendment number two, okay, because that deals with the condition of probation, which for concealing.
Okay.
This deals with the charges. I want the charges to be equitable.
All right. Okay. So we have before us amendment number one that addresses the condition when a person has been charged with a crime. So if a person is charged with a felony and they are found to be carrying a concealed weapon while charges are pending, they would be charged with a second felony. However, if a person were charged with a misdemeanor and they were found to be carrying a concealed weapon while the charges was pending, then they would be charged with a misdemeanor for carrying a concealed weapon. Is that accurate, Jeannie?
Yes, and one other thing is on page 1B, line 5, a person on release under 4712-80-080, those would be your juveniles.
Those would be?
The juvenile.
Oh, okay.
Statute. So it does also separate adult from juvenile.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize because I also was presenting a bill in front of a committee when this was heard. But what happens if the person that's being charged is found innocent? And so that there's a conviction that never occurs, and then they've been charged with something else. Now do we need to go through a court legal battle all over again for them to be, to have the second thing taken care of also?
Representative Dahlstrom, through the chair, that for Representative Lynn's edification is also the point that Brian Judy wanted to bring forward. So that would have been his question and testimony to that. But since the crime, is charge, the first charge, they're out on bail, and the judge would be saying to them, you may not be carrying a weapon. So it is a second charge because they broke the rule that the judge had asked them not to break, carrying concealed. He may even go further and say not to carry even a firearm. This is narrower for just being concealed. So it is a a second charge. If he's innocent of the first, it's still a charge that he would have to deal with, or she would have to deal with.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. And just to follow up, I mean, you brought up the difference between, you know, a concealed carry arm and other firearms, that the judge might make that. And for me, it's still, I believe that I agree with the intent of the bill, but it appears that it's aimed at concealed carry weapons and not really the others. The sponsor statement talks a lot about gang activity, but I don't, in reading this, I didn't see a lot of other things that pertain to gangs. And I don't know, I just have some concerns about constitutional rights that people have to. And again, I apologize for missing that first discussion, and I don't know, I have not spoken with anyone, you know, from the NRA or anything on this, my first hearing on this, but those are the things that jump out at me.
Representative Johnston through the chair, excuse me, Dahlstrom through the chair. We asked the drafter of the bill to look at the constitutionality of it, and I'm not sure if Jerry Luckup's online, but he indicated to me that there wasn't a constitutional problem because the judge would be charging them with the he'd be telling them with the statement that they should not be carrying a concealed weapon. It would be a condition of release for them to be on bail, not to carry. And he would usually, in some cases, it'd be a firearm. In domestic violence, it'd be firearms altogether.
Okay, and a follow-up, and maybe this is for you, or maybe Ms. Carpinetti could answer this question. I don't understand how it can be constitutional to take away certain rights from people if they haven't been convicted.
Mr. Chairman, on that point,
Representative Cargill.
I think there are times when conditions of bail have limited travel on rights to go to certain places. So there have been significant limitations, I think, put on people. This would hit the edge because it's a constitutional right to keep and bear arms, no doubt. But your right to free speech is going to be curtailed to some degree. There's a whole bunch of rights, I think, that dependent on the magnitude of the crime being charged, I suppose, the limitations of the bail. But then we have a whole question on what can a judge do under the bail circumstances. And I think what we didn't want to do is say it, you could get a greater charge for a lesser crime. And that was my biggest concern.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Samuels. Representative Lynn.
Yes. This, we're talking about concealed weapons. What about weapons that are not concealed? Does this apply to that?
It does not. This is narrower to the point of concealed.
So then if I were to commit a felony, maybe involving spousal abuse, sexual abuse, whatever, I can't carry concealed, but I can walk right into somebody's house with it out in the open. Does that make sense?
Well, in some cases it does, because the person who is say, in your domestic violence, it would be you can react differently if you know the gun is coming, as opposed to it being concealed. It is a baby step in my estimation, but I don't believe the NRA or many other people would go for complete guns, unless the judge is actually saying, in the case of some bail, where they say you cannot carry firearms at all, and that'd be all of them.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, and to the sponsor, for people that might fall in that category, wouldn't they be behind bars? They wouldn't be out on the street if the whatever it was they were being charged with was so serious that they were.
Domestic violence is all misdemeanors.
That's a valid point.
And you can have as many misdemeanors as you want in the same effort, and it's still a misdemeanor.
Are the is the objection to Amendment Number 1 maintained?
Yes.
You maintain the objection. All right, Madam Secretary, Susan, would you take the roll, please?
On Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 225, Representative Coghill.
Yes.
Representative Samuels.
Yes.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
Yes.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
Representative Rammers.
Yes.
Six yes, one no.
Okay, amendment number one passes. We now have amendment number two before us by Representative Coghill. Representative Coghill, will you move amendment number two?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number two, which is M.3.
Is there an objection?
I'll object.
Representative Dahlstrom objects for the purposes of discussion. Representative Coghill?
This deals with the condition of bail. This actually then would define under what a judge can do. A court may prohibit a person from possessing a concealed firearm while on release under the statutes 1230, which is going to be a misdemeanor, and 1141, which is going to be your felony crimes. So that's the authorizing language.
Are there other questions on amendment number two? Representative Gruenberg?
Yes, I was wondering if the Department of Law has any comments.
Ms. Carbonetti, do you have any magic answers? Yes, ma'am. It's always nice to see you.
Edwards of the committee. This is Annie Carpinetti, and I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law, and I profusely apologize. I was prepared for this hearing with the wrong draft.
Annie, it's okay. You do great. You do impeccable
this
work.
Is
so
the original is mandatory.
Let's take an ease for a moment. On the record, the full committee is in attendance. It's 2:25. We've been joined by our friend Jerry Luckup. Thank you for all of your help to the Judiciary Committee this year, Mr. Luckup. And Annie, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here. Things work better when you're in our committee room. So we thank you for assisting us with the problems that we may have or may or may not have with Amendment Number 1. And I'm not sure how we want to go about this, whether we want to Representative Gruenberg?
Could we just ask them what they want to do?
I wouldn't make it through this committee without your help. Representative Gruenberg, yes.
Amendment number two is before us.
Do we have amendment number two before us?
Yes.
Okay. So amendment number two has been offered, and there's an objection for the purposes of discussion. So if we can address that first, Annie and Jerry, if you can weigh in with your thoughts on amendment number two, and at that point we can go back and revisit amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for your indulgence.
Sure.
I have concerns about amendment number two because it makes it discretionary whether it says a court may prohibit possession of concealed firearms while on release for certain crimes. And my concern is that right now the court has discretion to impose that condition on any crime. And by adding this in the language that it's written, I'm concerned that a court will think those are the only circumstances where I can impose this condition and will actually limit their court's discretion. And there are lots of other cases besides a felony crime against a person where a court would want to prohibit a person out on bail from carrying any weapon at all, let alone a concealed weapon. Mm-hmm. That's my concern with amendment number two.
Okay, let's stay focused on that. Representative Coghill?
So at this point, the discretion for both misdemeanors and for felonies is there now?
Yes. Through the chair, yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, with amendment number one in dividing the charges, did that make any difference with regard to this?
I don't think they're necessarily connected. Do you?
Okay.
No.
Then I think that is there a place where that permissive language is clear in statute apart from this?
I know there are sections in our bail law that address it specifically, like for domestic violence. I guess I would have to look over the bail law to see if there's any other.
Representative Holmes, would you like to chime in? Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question. Amendment number two modifies or replaces Section 3 of the bill. Annie, do you have the same concern about Section 3 of the bill as you have about the amendment?
Less so, but a little bit, yes, I have the same concern.
So, if I may.
Because it's mandatory in this, and you can argue, well, although it's mandatory for these crimes, it's also still discretionary. And, our, you know, after that question by Representative Coghill, it occurred to me that all of our bail provisions have a catch-all saying that the court can order a bail, a condition of bail necessary to protect the public or the victim.
Representative Holmes?
Thank you. So is it your recommendation that we, for clarity, are you recommending that we not accept Amendment Number 2 and that we actually also delete Section 3 of the bill and leave it to the underlying bail statutes? Is that your recommendation, or do you have another recommendation for how to handle this?
My recommendation would be not to adopt 2 for the reasons I stated. I think Section 3 will be okay as long as there's testimony in the record that there's no intention by the legislature to limit a court's discretion to impose that condition under any other circumstances and in relation to any other charges.
Okay.
Mr.
Luckup, you drafted Amendment Number 2. What are your thoughts after conferring with Annie Carbonetti and her concerns?
Well, there would be an issue with Amendment Number 2 and vis-a-vis what authority the courts would still have to restrict someone's possession of a handgun. I would agree with Ms. Carbonetti on that. I don't really have a problem with Section 3 of the bill being in there because it is mandatory. It says the court shall prohibit someone from possessing a concealed handgun in these particular crimes. There is nothing that would be in conflict in my interpretation of the existing laws and their ability, a court's ability to restrict the possession of a handgun under those bail conditions.
Representative Coghill?
And I guess that was probably the problem I had, was that it was a directive in all of those circumstances. And I thought it should be permissive. And if it's already permissive, then in my mind, we take Section 3 out. Otherwise, I think we should go in a permissive mode. And part of my argument, if you remember correctly, was for those misdemeanants where the first one to get the charge for whoever got into fisticuffs, the first one to go get the charge is the one that gets the misdemeanor charge, the fourth degree assault. And under this condition of Section 3, as it's written, they are now having their right to keep and bear arms infringed because somebody got to do the first charge. I don't know that that's what I would want to have done, and that's why I thought the permissive language would be better. And the domestic violence just fits under those statutes, if I understand correctly. So that's my whole purpose.
Okay. Representative Coghill, do you intend to?
I will maintain the Amendment 2. I will go to the will of the committee. But remember, the directive, it makes it a special circumstance that under all bail releases, somebody's going to have a judge directed to tell them they can't keep a concealed firearm. That's under all conditions. And so I just don't know that I want to go there yet.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
I'm just still trying to get my head around where we are on these three, the underlying bail statute, Section 3, and the amendment. So I apologize. Bear with me. So the intent of Amendment Number 2 is to make it permissive where Section 3 is mandatory. I'm trying to figure out whether the language of Amendment 2 is already fully covered under existing bail statutes.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that's what I think Ms. Carbonetti indicated. And if that's the case, then I would go to strike Section 3 and leave it to the courts.
Okay. Representative Grimberg?
I believe the statutes are clear that the court can impose any restrictions she believes is necessary. And if I may read the statute, AS 1230.020, subsection B, 7, it reads, if a judicial officer determines under A of this section that the release of the person will not reasonably assure the appearance of the person or will pose a danger to the alleged victim, other persons, or the community, the judicial officer may impose any other condition considered reasonably necessary to assure the defendant's appearance as required and the safety of the alleged victim, other persons, or the community. That, I believe, allows the judge to impose reasonable conditions in any case, including that they can't carry a gun.
So you would have, okay. The question has been called on amendment number two. Susan, would you take the roll, please?
Representative Samuels.
No.
Representative Lynn.
Yes.
Representative Holmes.
Pass.
Representative Gruenberg.
No.
Representative Dahlstrom.
No.
I'm sorry.
No.
Representative Coghill.
And I have to vote against my own amendment.
I'm so happy.
Somebody else.
I'm going to vote no on it.
Representative Rammers.
No.
Thank you for hanging
around. Representative
me
Holmes.
No.
Sorry, one yes, six no.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
With that, I'm going to move that we, a conceptual amendment to strike Section 3 from the statute.
Is there an objection to conceptual amendment number 3? Representative Holmes objects for discussion.
The discussion is that I'm not a big fan of that particular directive, and since I've been told under the statutes presently that they are able to do that, I think the bill as it stands with its other language is directive enough and holds them accountable, and it gives the judges tools. And since I voted against my own amendment to get to this particular place and hung out my good friend to my left here, Mr. Lynn, I think that it's only wise that we leave the court the discretion and get this directive out.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, Annie, is that your understanding is that the court at this point does have the discretion both for misdemeanors and for felonies to impose this as a condition?
Yes, through the chair, that is my understanding.
Is the objection maintained?
I will remove my objection.
So the objection is removed. Conceptual amendment number 3 passes. Annie, do we have Representative Gruenberg?
Maybe you were going to say what I was.
I was.
Sorry.
Just give me just a minute. I
apologize.
Thank you. Annie, do you have any concerns about amendment number 1 that was passed by this body when you first came in?
Mr. Chairman, I do, especially since
Section 3 has been released,
and I think it may be just technical fine-tuning. Right now, it is a misdemeanor, a Class A misdemeanor, to violate any condition of release, and that's under AS 1156-757A, other than failure to appear, which is already a crime. So I think what we need to do is make sure that we get, I don't think it's, from my understanding, it's not the intent of the sponsor to change that for other conditions, but it would be the intent of the sponsor to make it more serious if the person was released under certain circumstances and carried concealed after a court had told him or her not to carry concealed. And
so being that amendment number 1 has passed, what are recommendations that you would offer for a conceptual amendment number 4 to remedy the deficiency that we adopted amendment number 1?
Mr. Chairman, I think we would have to fine-tune B on page 1, line 12, because there's no longer 1230.018.
Are you in the bill? Are you in the bill, or are you on the amendment?
I'm in the bill.
Bill.
What? Where were we? Oh, I see.
Page 1, line 12. Is that right? B.
Yes.
The requirement.
No, line 13. Apologies.
Okay. The requirement not to possess a concealed firearm under AS 12.30.018.
Which we just eliminated that section. So I'm assuming the committee and the sponsor wants to make it a more serious crime to carry concealed after you've been ordered by a court not to under certain circumstances. And I will work with Mr. Luckup and the sponsor to do that.
All right. If that's so, then I think we may set this bill aside and bring it back. Do you think you can get to that tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm also looking at Section 4 of the bill. The applicability also references Section 018, so I would just call their attention to that section as well.
Okay. What page, line?
Bottom of page 3.
Line 28.
I see.
Okay. All right. Ladies and Mr. Luckup, sounds like a dance team, doesn't it? Ladies and Mr. Luckup. Okay. So with that, we will set House Bill 225 aside pending that improvement. I'd like to take it up on Thursday. Is it the best day to take it up on Thursday? Let me go over our schedule before we adjourn for the day. We are going to add a Thursday meeting, as you just learned. Tomorrow's Tuesday. We will have a session. However, it'll begin at 1:30, as the Vice Chair and I have a meeting with the Attorney General prior to that. We're going to take up Thursday we will begin at 1:30 also. We are going to take up two bills tomorrow. One is House Bill 194, which was crimes and offenses, increasing the fines and then addressing the difference between a police officer and a peace officer and the two different definitions of a peace officer. And Heath from Representative Gatto's office told me that, I don't recall who was going to, somebody's going to come testify for us who is expert in that field, and we'll find out whether they clarify or muddy our impression of 194. And then the second bill that we're going to turn our attention to, which is an interesting policy call. It was the RCA bill, House Bill 209, that addresses not only timelines, which is, I would say, the less controversial aspect in the same way that crimes and offenses, increasing the crimes or the, or increasing the fine is the less difficult part, either you're for it or against it with the RCA's timelines. But the interesting component that I'll ask the members to consider tomorrow in House Bill 209 is whether the chair of the RCA should be appointed by the governor, which creates its own political backdraft, or whether the chair should continue to be elected by the commissioners of the RCA, which is the dominant element, and it was handled by Labor and Commerce, but not conclusively. So the bill's been passed our committee, and it suggested considerable policy call by the members. So that will be a cumbersome piece to get through. At least it was in Labor and Commerce. So with that, 1:30 tomorrow for House Bill 194, 209, we will take up this bill, House Bill 225, first thing on Thursday. And tomorrow at 1:30, Wednesday for the regular scheduled meeting at 1, Thursday at 1:30, and then Friday for the regular scheduled meeting. So with that, at 2:40, we're adjourned.